This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Over the last five seasons, the Golden State Warriors made one of the greatest runs in NBA history. It started in 2014-15 with a championship lineup led by Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green, and another teammate who made some big adjustments for the sake of the Warriors' success. Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story.
Tell me, what's your name and what do you do?
Andre Iguodala. I am a human being. That's what I do. I try to human being, which is live life.
I appreciate that. And you're a basketball player on the side, I suppose.
Yeah, I play basketball on the side. A lot of people know me for that.
Back in the summer of 2013, Andre Iguodala was at a crossroads. After 9 years in the NBA, he was a free agent for the first time. Iguodala had made the NBA All-Star team 2 years earlier, and he'd built a reputation as a durable player and a hard-nosed defender. A couple teams pursued him, but he knew where he wanted to play next.
Seeing the Golden State Warriors play and seeing their coach, Mark Jackson, at the time, I said, next place I go to, I'm going to do it somewhere where I can enjoy it and get the most out of myself.
Iguodala says he was also investing in some tech companies at the time. The Bay Area seemed like a perfect fit. At first, he and the Warriors couldn't come to terms on a deal. He got close to signing with the Mavericks and even started looking for apartments in Dallas. But one day, when he was working out with his friend and former teammate Evan Turner, Iguodala got a call from his agent. Golden State had come up with the money to sign him.
But they won't do it unless you commit to them now. And I was able to make the commitment and it got done.
Iguodala had played 695 career games with the Philadelphia 76ers and the Denver Nuggets. And he had started every single one of them. So he wasn't surprised when Warriors head coach Mark Jackson told him that he had earned a starting spot on his new team.
I never asked the question of, am I going to start or not? You know, just go out there and compete. For me, that was never something that crossed my mind.
Iguodala started all 63 games he played for Golden State in 2013-2014. The Warriors made the playoffs as the number 6 seed in the West before losing to the LA Clippers in the first round. Iguodala and Mark Jackson had a meeting after the playoffs ended. Iguodala says he left the conversation feeling good about his coach's offseason suggestions.
A few hours later, he got fired. It was like kind of like a shock, like I just talked to him.
A week later, Iguodala was introduced to his new head coach, Steve Kerr. Like Iguodala, Kerr had also played under Hall of Fame coach Lute Olson at Arizona.
I always joked and said we had the same karate master. You know, he got both of us to the black belt, being that we both weren't able to play in the NBA. So similar principles, seemed pretty laid back. So I've been through a lot of coaches, so it was always the fear of the unknown, not knowing what to expect. And it's like you have to kind of prove yourself all over again. But Steve, I felt like Steve was a genuine person, so felt good going into training camp. And actually had a really good training camp. So I felt really good. I felt the best I felt in a while.
But just before the start of the 2014-2015 season, Kerr approached Iguodala during a team practice.
He just flat out told me.
Kerr told Iguodala that he was playing well enough for a spot in the starting lineup. But instead of starting, he was going to come off the bench. With Steph Curry and Klay Thompson emerging as elite scorers, Kerr said, he wanted to save some productivity for the Warriors' second unit. Iguodala knew that this was a good basketball move. It made sense for the team. But still,
I was in a good place and I was playing really well. And, you know, for someone to say, you know, you earned a spot but you didn't get it, you know, that had a little sting to it. So it was an adjustment because it was a place I'd never been.
Iguodala says as a starter, it had been his job to set the tone for the game. Coming off the bench, Coach Kerr had a different challenge for him.
It was always fine to flow, you know, make the extra pass, get our pace right. When we were moving too fast, slow us down. We were moving too slow to speed us up a little bit.
Iguodala is known as a cerebral player. He understood what he had to do to help his team. But making the most of his intermittent playing time was hard.
Well, there'd be times, you know, Steve say, come in, you know, find a flow, and I find a flow, and then I'm like, okay, now it's my time where I can, you know, get up a shot, or I can get into my individual game and make that part work. And it'd be like, all right, sub, you did your job. And he'd be like, all right, my flow was thrown out, finding the team's flow. Some nights I was too hard on myself, and I remember Steph saying, oh, you know, this thing's rolling because you're a big part of it, and just keep believing in it. And it's like, I know I believe in it, but I can't find my maximum self.
As Steph Curry said, things were rolling. Golden State started the season 23-3. Curry was on pace to set a new NBA record for three-pointers in a season, and he looked like a bona fide MVP candidate. But even with everything going right in the Bay, Iguodala still had a really tough time adjusting to his new role. He says his trainer would get texts from friends saying he'd, quote, fallen off. He wondered whether moving to the bench signified the start of a new chapter in his basketball career, one of mediocrity and irrelevance.
You go through a whole half, and it was like you had two shots, and you'd have two assists, and you have three rebounds, and it was like, your stats say you played bad, but the Steve would be like, you played awesome tonight. You're the reason why we're winning. And it's like, nah, I don't see it like that, you know. It took me a while to understand, you know, sometimes numbers do lie, and sometimes numbers don't tell the entire story.
Iguodala finished the 2014-15 regular season averaging career lows in minutes, points, and rebounds. But Golden State won a league-best 67 games, and their sixth man had gotten more comfortable in his role.
Barbosa to Bogut, back to Iguodala!
By the time the Warriors reached the 2015 NBA Finals against LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers, Iguodala says he was more confident than ever.
I call that getting Iggy with it.
With Iguodala coming off the bench, the Warriors won Game 1, but they lost Game 2 and Game 3. Another loss would put them on the brink of elimination. So just before Game 4, Steve Kerr approached Iguodala again. But this time, he told him he was back in the starting lineup. It had been over a year since the 31-year-old veteran had started an NBA game.
It wasn't a feeling of overly excited or, you know, not like I told you so, but it was okay. You know, I know exactly what needs to be done, and we're going to get it done. I think it was good timing. So I felt like, yeah, that whole season of the ups and downs, sometimes not knowing what was going to come the next day and not being unsure of yourself some days and working through those things kind of helped everything come to fruition now ultimately at the end.
Back out, Iguodala puts up the three, knocks it down. Iguodala with his third three-pointer of the game.
With Iguodala starting, the Warriors won Game 4. And Game 5.
Kerr said things seem to run smoother when Iguodala's on the floor. He has truly been the difference maker.
And that decisive Game 6 in Cleveland.
And the dream season is now complete. The Golden State Warriors are the 2015 NBA champions. Their first title in 40 years.
I was just so happy. I don't think I've ever been like that excited about basketball.
And for Iguodala, there was one more reason to celebrate, albeit in an arena full of disgruntled Cleveland fans.
This year's Bill Russell MVP, Andre Iguodala.
This year, Andre Iguodala started 15 of Golden State's 22 playoff games. It's unclear what his role will be for the Warriors next season. But he does say the bench has grown on him.
Yeah, I've learned to embrace it, actually. You know, now Steve's like, you're starting. I'm like, no, I don't want to start anymore. You know, so it's funny how that's worked out.
That story came from Only a Game's Matthew Stock. Andre Iguodala's new book is called The Sixth Man. It's time for three stories you should know.
I want to thank the front office, the ownership, for believing in me. And I was 18 years old back in Greece.
That's Milwaukee Bucks forward Giannis Antetokounmpo speaking after he was named the NBA's most valuable player on Monday. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Karen.
And by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me. We're also global. Just wanted to make that clear.
Ken, I'm turning it over to you.
Well, this week I'm looking at the progression of the NBA's journey to globalization, something we've been hearing about forever. And this week we saw Giannis, the Nigerian from Greece, winning the MVP award. Rookie of the Year, we have a Serbian, Luka Doncic. Mrs. Clemente, my high school French teacher, helps me with the rest. The Defensive Player of the Year, Rudy Gobert. And then the most improved player, Pascal Siakam from Cameroon and Gobert from France. And let us not forget that the championship of the league is now Toronto. This really, to me, is a turning point where it's not just a novelty.
It's a great point, and this clean sweep of the major award by international players is a fascinating development. Foreign-born players have won the MVP before, Hakeem Olajuwon and Dirk Nowitzki, and two-time MVP Steve Nash, a Canadian and a South African.
That's right.
Basketball is a fun game, an aesthetically appealing game, and I could see why the world would love it. But why is it that more so than any other American sport, it attracts international talent? And I have this theory, which is that readily to the eye, it is quite easy to salivate and get excited about potentially good basketball players insofar as that they are tall. They are sometimes in the 0.5% of the population. And I just think that in other sports, it's less easy.
You can't coach height.
Exactly. There is no doubt that basketball is becoming more international, and I'm a big fan of that. But, you know, Commissioner Adam Silver has said that he thinks basketball can become the number one sport in the world, and that just kind of seems crazy to me. Ken, do you think basketball will ever catch up to the sport the rest of the world calls football?
No, nor cricket. I mean, you know, it's not a game that has a deep history in countries in the way that soccer has a deep history just about everywhere in the world.
All right. The IOC has announced new reforms to the Olympic bid process. In the past, reforms have attempted to make hosting the games more affordable. These reforms focus on, among other things, making sure that host cities have public support. And that seems logical and important. But do not be fooled. The IOC hasn't developed a sudden concern for taxpaying citizens. No. As Australian IOC member John Coates put it, quote, "We can't continue to be damaged as we have been in the past." He's referring to the trend of cities starting to bid for the games only to drop out due to a lack of local support. You may remember Boston's brief 2024 bid. And I'm left wondering, is there anything in these reforms that is actually going to make things better for bid cities? Or is it all about making things better for the IOC?
You know, I read that and understand it to be more of a slow walk process. It's not going to be a situation anymore where we look for the best deal at that moment. But we're going to massage and work with several venues and see how well they do. So they're actually in some ways extending the competition in a way that they haven't done before. So the whole magic envelope and, you know, Obama flying in for 2 hours, which wasn't long enough, that event, you know, they're trying to do away with it. And also, too, I think it's they're trying to push away from that somebody loses kind of moment. This is part of the everybody gets a trophy kind of aura.
I think that it would be wrong to see the IOC as being proactive. They're really being reactive. For a while, there were no bids for one of the Winter Olympics. And it's been pretty clear for a while that the only kind of countries that are interested in bidding for the Olympics are totalitarian regimes, or at least oppressive regimes, who could use them to burnish their credentials.
Wait, wait, LA 2028? Come on, man.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to cast aspersions on Mr. Garcetti yet. But the point is, if you are an autocrat, the Olympics are so much more attractive to you. And Thomas Bach knows this, and he's an Olympian and not only head of the IOC, and it bothers him. But they also have this structure where the first, second, third through 10th thing that has to be satisfied is that all the money sloshing around goes to the right people. So it's a really bad situation that I think there's no coming back from the brink with, and this is just tinkering on the edges.
I got to say, Mike, I had the same sort of reaction to you. I thought, okay, so the IOC is going to be going into these countries with sort of no history with democracy, like no dissent. And they're going to be asking people, do you support this? And they're going to say, yes, because that's the only answer that's allowed, you
right,
know?
Right, right, right. It'll look like a Saddam Hussein reelection campaign.
All right, Mike, you're up.
Well, golf is, I would say, just about my least favorite sport. It is the elitism. It is the elitism that bothers me. And in The New Yorker, Nick Paumgarten wrote just a fantastic piece called Inside the Cultish Dream World of Augusta National. And there are points in the New Yorker story when they clarify phrases like, talk about Tiger Woods, he had his driver out. The club that hits the ball the farthest, the one you use off the tee. And so to me, Augusta, being so particular and so fussy and so elitist about some of its phrases, is exactly like The New Yorker, which is a magazine I love, you know, still using the two dots over cooperate. It's not an umlaut. What is that? I don't want to say diuretic because I'm not an elitist.
Is this where I get to bring up the time when you were forced to explain what a three-point shot was?
Yes, an early NPR editor thought to clarify that.
Ken, what do you make of this?
Well, I sacrilegiously listened to the New Yorker article shortly after I saw the piece on the Red Sox flying to London in this charter crystal sky luxury jet thing. All this stuff was just a reminder as I near retirement age that I haven't made it. I mean, the article was talking about, you know, the pimento sandwiches and the greens with the pipes underneath, all this stuff that is just so far out of the realm of normalcy. Whatever you think about Bernie Sanders, I mean, he keeps raising it. There is this 1% that's got some things that most of us have not a clue about. And that's what that article did for me.
Yeah, I really couldn't decide what my favorite details from the story were. I mean, it's certainly not new news that Augusta is the epicenter for privilege. But this sort of detail on what is going on there really, to me, was incredibly interesting, Mike.
Oh, my God. I can report with confidence that it's called the diuresis. I did look that up.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Ken, when you talk about the 1%, this is really the 0.01%.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a takedown. It's not an expose. It's just a glimpse into this hidden Shangri-La. And the thing that it reminds me most, I just read this excellent biography of Kim Jong-un, which is to say, wow, that's crazy.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute, and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal, dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
Drag has been around for a while.
In the kabuki tradition in Japan, in minstrel shows, in vaudeville.
But one TV show made it mainstream now. We break down drag's current renaissance. Check out NPR's It's Been a Minute now.
I'm Karen Given. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The modern-day sport of trail ultramarathoning began 45 years ago when a man showed up to a 100-mile horse race without a horse. An ultramarathon is defined as anything longer than 26.2 miles. And it's true. Tens of thousands of people every year run 50, 100, even 1,000 miles over rough terrain because of that man and his non-existent horse. But the story of ultramarathoning actually begins with another man named Wendell Roby and another horse.
Wendell's a little guy. It's just, he's strong, he's wiry, and he wears cowboy boots. Well, he doesn't anymore. He died in 84.
That's Gordon Ainsley. Most people call him Gordy. He was a friend of Wendell's back in the day. In 1954, Wendell Roby was camping with the Sacramento Horsemen's Association at Robinson Flat, 30 miles west of Lake Tahoe. And while sitting around the campfire on the last night of the trip,
Wendell was bragging about what a great horse he had, and one of the guys said, you can't compare that to the great horses of the last century. And Wendell says, well, what could they do that my horse can't? And the guy said, well, they could go 100 miles over mountains and desert. Oh, excuse me, I got a phone call. Anyway, and so Wendell said, well, what about mountains and canyons? And so he got a few of his friends together, and they rode from Tahoe to Auburn. Wendell only planned to do it once, but then so many people said, God, if I thought you had any chance at all, I would have come with you.
That's how the Western States 100 Trail Ride, now known as the Tevis Cup, began. And this is where I should probably mention that Gordy Ainslie isn't just an old friend of Wendell Roby's. He's now better known as the father of ultramarathoning. For Gordy, much as for Wendell, the Western States started with a horse.
When I was a kid, I actually subscribed to Lone Ranger comic books.
Gordy dreamed of owning a horse of his own. And years later, while attending college at UC Santa Barbara, he finally bought a horse named Rebel.
And the lady said someone had told her that it would make a good endurance horse. I said, what's that?
A good endurance horse is what was needed to finish the Western States 100. By this point, 1971, Wendell Roby's Trail Ride was well established as one of many endurance horse races around the world. Rebel turned out to be a very good endurance horse, but Gordy was not an ideal rider.
You know, I weighed 200 pounds. Well, I weighed more than that. I weighed 205.
Gordy says most riders walk their horses on the downhills. Running or trotting them with weight on their backs puts too much pressure on their front legs. Instead, Gordy hopped off Rebel's back and ran down the hills.
And, you know, I'd be passing all these people who were walking their horses.
Gordy's very clear on this. He says he's never been a great runner. He never had a lot of talent. But from the time he was very young, he'd learned to find solace in running.
I just felt really out of place. We were Seventh-day Adventists. We went to church on the wrong day. My mom and grandma who raised me, I didn't have a dad. You know, that made me feel really, like, undeserving. I don't know. I wanted to belong so much, you know, and it's like, I remember this one day I think it was second grade. I came out on the playground and with a bag lunch. Grandma had packed the lunch and I couldn't see anybody I could go up to and say, you want to have lunch? I panicked and I just felt like I couldn't breathe. And I just dropped my lunch and I ran home for lunch.
Gordy says that was his first run. Soon he was running to school whenever he missed the bus so that he didn't have to bother his mother for a ride. And then in junior high, he had a teacher who treated gym class like military PT drills, lots of push-ups. Gordy hated doing push-ups.
You know, I'd goof off and he'd make me run. And I made sure I wore a real pained expression whenever he could see me. And I was having a good time.
And that brings us back to the early 1970s, when Gordy, running almost as often as he was riding, and Rebel finished two Western States trail rides.
He didn't really like me that much, but we had a lot of fun together.
But after that second ride, in the summer of 1972, Gordy met a woman.
And she wanted to get married and have kids, and she also wanted me to give her my horse. And I figured, well, you know, we're going to spend our lives together, so I gave her my horse.
And then, Gordy says, the woman dumped him, but she kept his horse. Gordy bought another horse for the 1973 Western States, but that horse went lame. That's when Gordy had a conversation with the secretary of the Western States Trail Foundation. Her name was Drusilla Barner.
Drusilla came up to me, and she always spoke for Wendell. I mean, they were just like one voice. And she invited me to run the next year, which was 74.
Run, as in without a horse. It was an interesting idea, but at first, Gordy brushed it off.
You know, I've always been a terrible procrastinator. It's historic. And so I expected, I'll just get another good horse by that time. Well, I didn't.
So training to run 100 miles over harsh terrain felt easier to you than getting a new horse?
Well, I hadn't gotten a new horse.
Right.
The whole thing with the evolvement of this incredible sport we have, it's such a verification of a Hindu saying that the most beautiful lotus flower will always be the one that grows out of a dung heap.
Actually, I think it's a Buddhist saying, but you get the idea. Gordy turned 27 years old that summer. He'd dropped out of college. He says he was aimless and depressed. And lacking anything better to do, he found himself visiting his old high school, where he started training for long-distance road races with the school's math and music teacher. That prepared him to run long distances, but he prepared for the grueling uphills and downhills of the trail by participating in a brand new sport called ride and tie. It doesn't really matter how it works. All you need to know is that it's a relay race involving teams of two runners and a horse. By the time the 1974 Western States came around, Gordy was in pretty good shape. He also had a new girlfriend.
I told my girlfriend, I said, well, I'm leaving at such and such a time. Can you go up with me? And she says, oh, no, I'm going to the jalopy races with Margaret Friday night. And I go, what? You know, it's like I felt really left alone and abandoned. Somehow I knew I'm about to do the most important thing I've ever done in my life, and she's not going with me. Now, how did I know it was? But of course it was, you know.
Gordy drove to camp on his motorbike and met up with a good friend. He calls her his sister. Her name is Diane.
Diane asked me, where are you going to sleep? I said, I don't know. She says, well, why don't you sleep on our horse trailer? So, you know, we scooped out the manure. I mean, horse poop actually doesn't smell that bad.
Gordy says the riders woke up early the next morning, at 3 or 3:30. They had to feed and water their horses and get everything set for the 5 a.m. start. Gordy stayed in bed for a while.
And finally I got up and I got ready to go. I had a lot of time because, you know, it doesn't take me as long to get ready for a run as a horse. About 10 minutes before the start, I went up to Ralph and Betty Deaver. They were sitting with a gas lantern, one of those old kind that goes, shh. You know,
yeah.
And I said, well, I guess I'll be going. And they said, well, good luck, Gordy. And I just disappeared into the darkness. It was like nobody knew it was happening. It was one of my favorite words is auspicious. This was very inauspicious. It was amazing.
Soon, the horses and their riders caught up to Gordy.
When we hit the single track trail, I had to go at their speed. You know, that was 8 miles an hour, and that was way faster than I wanted to run. Well, for 100 miles, you know. I got to the 40-mile point, and I just said, you know, I'm never going to make this. It was 107. It was so hot, I couldn't even focus. So I got to the point where I said, well, what can I do? And this voice from inside me said, I can still take one more step.
Gordy told himself that as long as he could still take one more step, he would. But on the climb to Devil's Thumb, where the trail rises 1,600 feet in 1.6 miles, Gordy decided to quit. When he arrived at the top, he found his good friend Diane.
So she came up to me and she goes, Gordy, how you feeling? And I go, I'm quitting. She goes, don't quit just yet. Come on over here under this tree and talk with Paige and me. So I did. And she correctly diagnosed what was wrong with me. I had run out of salt. See, because there weren't any aid stations.
That's right. Gordy Ainslie had set out to run 100 miles in a race without a single water stop. The Thursday before the race, he'd bought 10 bottles of Gatorade and, using his motorbike, had stashed them along the course.
And I thought that'd be plenty. I mean, 10 quarts? I mean, how much could you need? Well, I found out you need a lot more than that.
Diane massaged Gordy's legs and gave him salt tablets and water.
And I couldn't believe it. It's like half hour later, I just felt fine.
So Gordy kept running. He ran all the way to the finish line in Auburn. By then, he'd decided to stop worrying about the girlfriend who'd left him feeling abandoned when she'd gone to the jalopy races instead of traveling with him to the start. Instead, he was trying to impress a rider who'd accompanied him to the finish.
I did a dive forward roll over the finish line, and they wrote it up in the paper that I'd done handspring. No, I can't. I never was good at handsprings, but I could do a dive forward roll.
For the record, Gordy and that rider soon started dating. Gordy didn't run the Western States the next year, 1975, but a man named Ron Kelly did. He dropped out just 2 miles from the finish.
It was like tragic. Well, it was more tragic for him than the rest of us.
Tragic, because by this time, Gordy had realized that his aspirations were greater than just being known as the guy who showed up to a 100-mile horse race and decided to run instead.
You know, if we're going to make this into a sport, we have to have more than me finish it, because at this point, I just look like a freak of nature that's a superhuman athlete. I knew I wasn't.
A year later, in 1976, a runner named Ken Shirk decided to give the Western States 100 a try. Everyone calls him Cowman.
And I decided, okay, I want to make sure this one finishes.
Gordy wasn't running again that year. He was working the Last Chance aid station, 43 miles from the start. When Cowman arrived at Last Chance, he was on pace to cross the line under the 24-hour limit. All he had to do was keep moving. Instead, he stopped to talk to Gordy.
Cowman loves to talk. He just loves to talk.
For the sake of accuracy, I have to point out that Cowman's not the only one who loves to talk. At this point in our conversation, Gordy and I had been talking for 34 minutes, and I'd asked 3 questions.
We were just chatting, mostly him chatting, you know. Finally, about a half hour later, I said, Cowman, you can't sit here and talk to me and make it to Auburn in 24 hours. Get out of here. So he left. And that 30 minutes, he was 30 minutes late. He would have made the 24 hours if he hadn't sat there and talked to me for a half hour. He was close enough that Wendell came up after the awards ceremony and said, Gordy, let's make this a yearly event. But Wendell doesn't talk like that. So he comes up to me, goes, Gordy, let's make this a yearly event. And I go, with advertising and the whole bit? He goes, with advertising and the whole bit. So I put this ad into Runner's World in the classifieds. It said, the ultimate challenge, 100 miles of cross-country running through the high mountains and deep canyons of Northern California's Sierra Nevada mountains.
That was 1977. 14 runners started the race. One finished in under 24 hours. 2 more in under 30. At what point did you realize that, like, you had started a sport?
Well, in 78, we had 60 or 62 participants.
It was 63. 30 finished, including Gordy, who attempted the race for the second time.
After that, I was talking to Drusilla, Wendell's secretary, and I said, do you think the run will ever be as big as the ride? And she said, oh, much bigger. Her and Wendell saw where it was going to go. I didn't see where it was going to go. I wanted to start an event, you know, and I realized in 78 that I'd succeeded.
The 2019 Western States is being held this weekend, 45 years after Gordy's first run. It's widely recognized as the world's oldest trail ultramarathon. In 1978, Gordy also helped establish the first 50-mile trail race. And soon after that, he stepped back from organizing races altogether.
I've never been a manager, you know. I'm a Gemini, you know. It's like I invent things. And so I went off to chiropractic college.
Dr. Gordon Ainsley received his chiropractic license in 1983. He's still treating patients, though at age 72, he's mostly retired. He's married and he still runs. And this sport he invented, the trail ultramarathon, it's grown a lot. In 2018, there were more than 115,000 ultramarathon finishers in more than 2,000 races in North America alone. Not bad for the boy who started running because he was so desperate to find a place where he belonged.
My grandma used to say, I had a lot of close calls when I was a kid, and she said, Gordy, the Lord is preserving you for a purpose. I kind of think she was right.
It's been 14 years since Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, challenged his warehouse crew to a friendly game of basketball.
Whoa, whoa, Naked aggression. You're right, Jim. Suck it up.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. So you're listening to this NPR podcast because you want to be informed. You want to learn something. But what if you need a little break? Well, then you want to check out Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. It's the show that lets your lizard brain enjoy itself for once. You can be serious again later. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we meet the engineer who brought her basketball skills to NASA. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
This week, Kevin Durant declined his $31.5 million player option with the Golden State Warriors and sold his Malibu home for $12.5 million. I assume these two items are unrelated, but what do I know?
Well, I don't know, but I think that $12 million is a nice little nest egg to put away, I think. No, I mean, I still don't understand this move. He could make $31 million just by going to rehab for a year. At his age, you don't bounce back from a ruptured Achilles tendon that easily. And yet he insists on, quote unquote, testing the market for a job he may not even be able to do next season. So, no, I don't understand this at all.
Meanwhile, in L.A., fans have rented two digital billboards over the I-5 to try to lure Kawhi Leonard to the Clippers. Kawhi grew up in L.A. Is that going to be enough to pull him away from the NBA champion Toronto Raptors?
Geez, I hope not. I mean, I'm just so happy for the Raptors and their fans, and I'm happy for Kawhi, who is definitively the star of the defending NBA champions now. And I don't understand the whole billboard thing. Does he go to LA like regularly and is he gonna see these billboards?
I don't know. They're in Downey, you know?
I mean, I'm sure that, you know, it'll gin up the fan base a little bit, but
750 million people watched the Women's World Cup in 2015. This time around, the ratings are on pace to break a billion. But, you know, nobody wants to watch women play soccer, right?
Absolutely not. You know, it's an un-American sport to start with, and there are girls playing it now. So, no, ew, icky, cooties. Yeah, this is going to be quite the phenomenon. And the United States women's national team has done a fabulous job creating and promoting a distinctive identity. It's been a remarkable performance on and off the field by these folks.
Well, here in the U.S., Fox has seen huge growth in the number of people watching the games and also the amount of money being paid by advertisers, which is now equal to what was paid to advertise during the 2014 men's tournament. And I might be oversimplifying this, but Fox did it by A, putting more games on TV, and B, charging advertisers more. Huh, you'd think somebody would have thought of that sooner.
Yeah, you wonder just what they're teaching in our business schools these days. Give them more product and charge more for it, and you will make more money. You know, this is a chicken and the egg thing, basically. Did the appeal of the sport cause the dynamic, or did the dynamic contribute to the appeal of the sport? Who knows? And at this point, who cares? Clearly, Fox doesn't.
Right. In a video released this week, Megan Rapinoe said that if the U.S. women win the World Cup, she will not be going to the bleeping White House. Later, she walked that back just a little bit.
I stand by the comments that I made about not wanting to go to the White House, with the exception of the expletive. My mom will be very upset about that.
So obviously that's the end of that controversy, right?
Oh, no. The other elements of the Fox television empire will certainly be all over this for a while. Kind of ironic, actually. I applaud her for not backing away from the sentiment. And no, she shouldn't go to the White House. In fact, no one should.
The governor of California has signed a bill that will give the California Horse Racing Board the authority to suspend track licenses to, quote, protect the health and safety of horses and riders. As we've mentioned before, 30 horses have died at Santa Anita since December. The bill was signed after that track closed for the season. Seems a bit late, eh?
Well, not only that, but Santa Anita has been allowed to keep the coming year's Breeders' Cup.
Yeah.
Which is a remarkable thing, as far as I'm concerned, given the situation at that track. Other than that, what you're saying about the governor's action is true. It's too little too late.
Yeah, I have to say I'm really surprised that the California Horse Racing Board didn't already have the power to close a track after dozens of horses have died. It seems like it shouldn't have taken a state law to make that possible.
You have absolutely no idea of what corrupt deals may have been made in the past to create whatever the racing regulations are. I mean, it's sort of like boxing in that way, the way boxing used to be when people cared about boxing. You just don't know what promises were made back in the day.
And finally, Charlie, Dodgers outfielder Cody Bellinger told reporters this week, quote, "I don't think my hugs are that special, to be honest. So for future reference, my hugs aren't that great, so don't rush me on the field." Why the sudden warning?
Because someone tried and actually got there.
Two people.
I appreciate Cody's humility. And I have absolutely no desire whatsoever to test out his theory. Just, you know, if he says that his hugs aren't any big deal, I will believe him.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
It's been 6 years since the Emmy Award-winning show The Office ended its run. But more importantly for sports fans, it's been 14 years since Michael Scott, the delusional regional manager of Dunder Mifflin, played by Steve Carell, challenged his warehouse crew to a friendly game of basketball.
The last time I was down there, I noticed they'd put up a couple of hoops. And I play basketball every weekend, so I thought, this might be kind of fun.
It was blue collar versus white collar, and the losing team had to work on Saturday. But the episode had bigger stakes for the show's main protagonist, Jim Halpert, played by John Krasinski. It was his chance to impress Pam, the office receptionist and the woman of his dreams, played by Jenna Fisher.
Basketball was kind of my thing in high school, and I'm looking forward to playing. You know, I think I'm going to impress a few people in here.
One problem. Pam was engaged to warehouse tough guy Roy Anderson, played by actor David Denman.
Pam, you kind of have your foot in both camps here. Why don't you do the jump ball, okay?
Don't listen to him, Pam. Trust me. Tip it my way or you're sleeping in the car.
Throughout the episode, Jim and Roy go head-to-head on the court. Only a Game's Nico Emack picks up the story from there.
In a real-life game, who do you think would win one-on-one?
John, 100%. 100%.
That's actor David Denman, who plays Roy from The Warehouse.
His whole family, they're giants, and they're all a basketball family. I think they coach ball. No, I'm not even going to pretend to play opposite, you know, that I would have a shot.
David never considered himself an athlete. Basketball was just something he did for fun as a kid.
All of my buddies were total jockheads. We would play basketball and break into gyms and go play ball. But, you know, I never really played it that competitively.
David says his earliest memory of the game is a sad one.
My parents split when I was a kid, and I lived in this apartment complex, and the only place there was to get out of the house was this basketball court. So I would go there by myself and just shoot hoops and, you know, till the sun went down. And I did that a lot for many, 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 many months.
As David got older, he found other avenues of expression. When he got to high school, he developed a passion for acting.
There was a kid in class who wanted to be an actor and was like, "I'm going to go to Juilliard." And I was like, "What is Juilliard?"
David graduated from Juilliard in 1997 and began his career in film and TV. He landed roles in movies like The Replacements and Big Fish. In 2004, he got a call from a friend living in New York.
And he said, "Oh, you got to watch this show. The Office is so up your alley. And I hear they're doing an American version. You gotta call your agent and get on that." So I watched it and I was like, gee, this is genius. And I called my agent and he at the time was like, "What? Really? You want to do that?" I said, "Yes." And then he was like, "They're looking for improv comedians." And I'm like, "Look, dude, I went to Juilliard. It's not just because I studied Shakespeare doesn't mean I can't do improv comedy. You know, we had that class as well."
David got the part. And on March 24th, 2005, the first episode of The Office aired on NBC. By that point, they had already filmed Season 1, Episode 5, creatively titled Basketball. Season 1, Episode 5, The Warehouse versus The Office. How did you and your fellow cast members react to the idea of playing basketball for an entire episode?
Well, we were excited because everyone was stuck in the office. So all of a sudden, we got to be in the warehouse. There was already a basketball, hoop in the parking lot, I think, that John used to always play on. and Brian.
Brian Baumgartner, who plays the slow-talking accountant, Kevin Malone.
At least once a year, I like to bring in some of my Kevin's famous chili.
Brian Baumgartner is, like, ridiculously good at basketball. That guy can shoot all day long. They were filming him, like, just shooting, like, three after three after three. I mean, like, he did, like, 15 in a row or something crazy.
David says the actors were always encouraged to improvise on set. But for most of the basketball scenes, a stunt coordinator was brought in to choreograph, like when Roy elbows Jim in the face.
Whoa, 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 foul, naked aggression. Oh, that is, you're right, Jim, suck it up.
The sad part about it is, in reality, he really did get hit in the face. I elbowed him. We worked on the beat of me, you know, faking and turning, but he got a little close and my elbow went up a little higher, and the adrenaline of the situation, you know, everything ends up oftentimes not working out exactly how you plan it. And it was just way too close. And I caught him on the lip, busted his lip up. He's bleeding. That's all real blood. And they're like, continue filming. And at a certain point, John's like, guys, I'm bleeding. Like, really? Can we stop filming and, like, stop this? And they had to shoot, like, they were supposed to shoot their first poster, you know, of what the show was going to be that next Saturday. And he got his lip busted in half, thanks to me. So I don't think John liked me too much the first couple of years.
After another foul, Steve Carell's character tries to end the game early.
Well, let's just say whoever was ahead won.
That was you.
It was us, really? I didn't know. I guess you guys working Saturday. Your face.
No, I'm not coming in on Saturday.
Yeah, this isn't happening.
How did you approach the role? And in particular, the role of such a, you know, to be frank, scumbag.
Yeah. I always like to try to find, you know, the other side of the character. Things just didn't quite work out for him the way he had planned. And so I found, like, a little empathy for that.
Later that day, Roy and Pam leave the office. Roy taunts Jim one last time.
Look at Larry Bird. Larry Legend.
Yeah, he's pretty good, huh? Yeah, let's get you into a tub.
Yeah, let's get you into a tub.
The camera stays on Jim. He's devastated watching the woman of his dreams leave with Roy. As a fan of the show, I felt for him. Luckily for everyone, Jim and Pam end up together in the end. Except
everyone forgets the fact that Pam cheated on Roy. Let's not forget who the cheaters are and who the bad people are in this, okay? Everyone always says, you know, why'd you do Jim like that? No, he did me like that. I had nothing to do with anything that went down other than being a numbskull.
People forget.
People forget. People forget. Pam is the cheater.
In real life, David Denman and John Krasinski are good friends. The pair co-starred in the movie 13 Hours. And just a few weeks ago, they were together at Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, cheering for the Bruins against who else but Jenna Fischer and her St. Louis Blues.
That's Only a Game's Nico Emack. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Special thanks this week go out to Dr. Donald Freeman, who lent us his studio to record Gordy Ainslie. Arlo Moore Bloom is our intern. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. If you liked today's episode, or even if you didn't, please subscribe to our podcast. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.